What's up, everyone? I'm Nick.
And I'm Em.
And welcome into the Ominous Archives. Got nothing today, Em. I think we're just going to jump right into it.
You got nothing? I'm ready. What do you have for me today?
So today's case is one of the most enduring mysteries in American history.
Hmm.
It's not just a cold case. It's not just a heist. It's a story that's outlived its investigation and one that's inspired books, documentaries, conspiracy theories, and more than a few paranormal theories along the way. This is the case of D.B. Cooper.
Hmm.
He's the man who jumped out of a plane with $200,000. And simply just vanished.
Poof, if you will.
Poof. Adios. We're going to cover the facts of the case, talk about the suspects, and look at how the FBI handled it. And since this is a podcast that dips into the strange, we'll also spend some time with some of the weirder theories, too. Because what is having a paranormal kind of podcast and not talking paranormal?
I'm very excited because I literally know nothing about this man other than the fact of what you just told me. He disappeared with the money and that was it and poof.
Well, we're going to get there in like 2 seconds. But
no, that's fine. I just wanted to give the preface that I'm excited.
DB actually wasn't even his name.
Oh, fun fact.
Yeah.
All right. So what was his name?
let's jump backwards in time.
Okay.
We're thinking like fall, to be exact, November 24th, 1971. The day before Thanksgiving.
I was just going to say, so Thanksgiving?
We're at the Portland International Airport. The moods are typical for a holiday weekend. Families rushing all over. Kevin's getting left behind.
Not Kevin.
Travelers are juggling bags and boarding passes. Nothing's too unusual. Nothing's alarming. And then just after 2 p.m., a man buys a one-way ticket to Seattle. Now, this is just a 30-minute flight. From Portland to Seattle.
Interesting.
He uses cash, $20. Kind of ironic for everybody who knows his case. And the name he writes on the ticket is Dan Cooper. He's described as quiet and composed, appearing to be in his mid-40s. He's dressed like a businessman, a dark suit, white shirt, black tie. He's neatly groomed, polished shoes. Nothing out of the ordinary.
Typical guy.
Yeah. He's carrying a briefcase and takes his seat in 18C, which is near the rear of the cabin on Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305. This is a Boeing 727. Hmm. Now, before takeoff, he orders a bourbon and a soda and sips it casually as the other passengers are settling in. The crew didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. There's no signs of him being agitated or being kind of strange, you know. Then, about 30 minutes after takeoff, a flight attendant named Florence Schaefer, who would come to be known as the only person to see Cooper's eyes during the hijacking, walks by. Cooper slips her a small piece of paper, and at first, she doesn't think much of it. She assumes it's just another passenger trying to flirt, maybe give a phone number, which was a common thing for flight attendants back then.
Yeah, that's normal.
But then he leans over, speaks in a calm, quiet voice. Miss, you better look at that note. I have a bomb.
Like, I don't even, what do you do? Like, what the heck? Like, I feel like my whole entire body would just go into, like, shock. Like, what do you mean?
Well, in all honesty, you do what she did.
Yeah, well,
like,
okay.
I think she played it perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, I think things are a little, I feel like everybody's a little more tense.
Yeah.
But I personally think she played it the exact way you should.
Yeah.
Don't freak.
Right.
Stay, you know, even keel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're, at that point, they're kind of in control.
Right. It's so, like, I don't know, it's just so crazy to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, what followed would become one of the most legendary moments in aviation history. Florence opens the note It's neatly printed. The message confirms the threat and includes very specific demands. $200,000 in unmarked bills, 20s specifically, four parachutes, two front and two back, and a fuel truck ready in Seattle for the next leg of the flight. The whole parachute thing, I'm not exactly sure what two front, two back mean.
Yeah, I don't know.
I assume that it's two main and then two spares. Yeah. I forget what they call them. But two of those ones, maybe.
Checks out.
Cooper opens his briefcase just long enough to show her the contents. Red cylinders, wires, what appears to be a battery. At this point, the crew doesn't question it.
Right.
They inform the pilots. The pilots inform air traffic control. And just like that, the FBI is involved. Now, early news reports mistakenly called him D.B. Cooper. They were rushing to try and get it out.
Yeah.
And they misheard Dan Cooper and turned into D.B.
Interesting.
Mixing up his first name and initials, the FBI never officially confirmed his real name, but the media's error stuck. And from that point on, the mysterious hijacker became forever known as D.B. Cooper.
That's wild.
Right?
It's not even like...
So it's not even like... You hear
Dan Cooper probably wasn't even his real name either, but he's probably like, all right, well, they couldn't even get that right.
Yeah, they didn't get that right, so I'm good. Good to go. I'm fine. What's striking about the early moments of the hijacking is how controlled it all was. He didn't shout. He didn't wave the briefcase around. He didn't threaten anyone unnecessarily. Everything was planned, precise, and quiet.
That's almost like more scary to me. Like, he's, like, so prepared. Mm-hmm. Like,
he knew what he was doing.
Yeah. This, like, he was ready. He wasn't panicking. Mm-hmm. There was nothing. Like, that's more scary.
Nah. From the outside, passengers likely had no idea what was happening at all.
Probably for the better. Mm-hmm. Do you want an entire plane of people freaking out because this random man has a bomb?
Exactly. Once the plane touched down in Seattle, the FBI and Northwest Airlines quickly delivered on Cooper's demands. The cash... $200,000 was gathered from the Seattle area banks. Parachutes were supplied by the local skydiving school. I heard at first, this is another one of those kind of like the Amelia Earhart, there's info, but there's always like also differing info.
Yeah.
I've also heard that there's a military base nearby and they originally got parachutes from there.
Mm.
And one of the things is he said, no, he doesn't want those.
Oh, he's picky.
You can't control military parachutes, apparently, on directions.
That's crazy.
So he wanted, what are we called? Pedestrian, I guess. You know, he wanted like regular ones. He didn't want a military style. I also heard he requested military style and not that.
Mm.
Either way, the parachutes were supplied by the local skydiving school. In exchange, Cooper allowed all 36 passengers to leave the aircraft unharmed.
How nice.
He only kept the pilot, the co-pilot, flight engineer, and one flight attendant, Tina Mucklow. The first flight attendant, who spent the most time with Cooper, offers personal insight into the hijacker's demeanor and behavior during the flight. He didn't show aggression. He thanked the crew. He stayed polite. It's kind of rare for a hijacker to kind of remain that composed.
You think?
They typically
just
are...
chill, relaxed. Yeah,
smooth.
Yeah. No aggression is kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. To buy a drink before takeoff, sit quietly mid-flight, and then negotiate a ransom with near-surgical precision. He didn't even raise his voice.
Right.
He was just cool, calm, and collected. He even, at one point, paid... for his drink.
Oh.
Huh. Uh-huh.
Dang, that is crazy.
He seemed to know the aircraft inside and out, especially the Boeing 727's unique design. This model had a rear staircase, known as the aft air stair. It could be lowered mid-flight, and Cooper knew about that. And more than that, He asked that it remain unlocked for the next part of his plan. Once the ransom and parachutes were on board, he instructed the flight crew to take off again, this time headed for Mexico City. But there were conditions. They had to fly below 10,000 feet and slowly, just under 200 knots. The cabin was to remain unpressurized, and he chose the flight path south-southeast toward Reno, Nevada, with a plan to refuel there if needed. It was an unusual request, especially for someone without a background in aviation, but Cooper wasn't making guesses. He seemed to know how to keep the plane flying just slow and low enough for a parachute jump.
He had to know. Like, you think he's going into this not knowing?
Yeah. As the plane climbed the darkening sky, the weather started turning. Heavy rain, winds gusting through the Pacific Northwest. Thunderstorms brewed. There also was two fighter jets that were like scattered to go and follow them. And the plane was going so slow that they couldn't go that slow.
Damn.
So they would have to keep trying to like loop.
Right.
To like keep an eye on him.
But like, he was probably thinking about that. Like, why do you think he wanted to go that low, that slow? Like, and then, the speed at which.
There was even an FBI helicopter that was did the same thing. It couldn't. It was like, it either couldn't keep up or it couldn't go slow enough.
Right.
Because, like, they didn't want to. I guess they didn't want to aggravate him.
Yeah, like, you don't want him to know that you're, like, on top of him. Mm-hmm. Right. Especially when he's not aggressive right now. Like, and yeah, like let's keep it that way.
And I forgot to mention earlier, well, you said how, like, he's calculated and everything.
Mm-hmm.
When they landed, he had them close all the window shades.
Mm.
So if there were snipers, they were null and void.
Right, because...
Because they don't know. They can't, see him. And there were snipers.
You know, I was just thinking about, like, how come they couldn't just, like, get him off the plane when... Yeah, I guess you don't think about the fact that he literally has hostages also on the plane with him, too.
Yeah, I really think he... I think everybody, you know, not being in, like, the police or the FBI or anything like that, I think... I personally think it was played well.
Yeah.
I think they did what they could. They prioritized the human life over the ransom.
Yeah.
And I think they did a good job at that.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is where to go.
Right.
So sometime after 8 p.m., near the Washougal River Valley in southwest Washington, the rear staircase of the plane lowered. The flight crew suddenly felt the change in cabin pressure. A little light lit up, indicating the rear stairs were dropped. And all of a sudden, the plane kind of kicked. The nose came up, and then the nose went down.
Mm-hmm.
One of those kind of jobbies. And they had no visuals, because Cooper sent everybody into the cockpit.
Right.
They called him over the mic, the intercom.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Cooper was gone. He jumped into the night with $200,000 strapped to his body and one of the parachutes. No one saw him land. No one knew where he went. He had disappeared completely into the darkness. And that's how the man known as D.B. Cooper became the center of the only unsolved airplane hijacking in U.S. history.
It's gotta be, like, so crazy for, like, I don't know, like, whatever. After he, like, got away with it, it's gotta be so crazy. Like, I'd be thinking to myself, like, damn, I am really the only person who ever got away with a hijacking.
Hey, yeah.
It's crazy.
So, he obviously, he had four parachutes left. I think he said one. He used one. One was cut up because the bag that they gave him the $200,000 in was kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
I have like a reusable shopping bag, but it's kind of like the real flimsy and flaky material that just falls apart. So he cut up one of the parachutes to then have to use that bag for the money. And there was also a dummy chute. I heard multiple things again. I'm going to lean with the school didn't realize that they gave him, like they gave a dummy one.
Mm-hmm.
It was like taped and stuff to say it was a dummy one. I did hear that.
Yeah.
So if he had any experience skydiving, he would have seen that and he would have known that that's a dummy chute.
Right.
Again, people say.
Hearsay, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's all hearsay. Like, It's people so say crazy. He had four shoots. He had four. He had he got two military shoots and two of the emergency backup shoots, and cut one up and one was left. But you know, I could completely see that accidentally happened. They gave him a dummy one, and I don't see him being so calculated to grab the dummy one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like he would know. He would see it. He'd read it. Even in the anxiousness at this point of having the money, now you just have to make your escape. I think he was calculated enough to realize. So let's talk about what came after his disappearance or his jump. The FBI launched what will become one of the most exhaustive manhunts in American history. They call it NORJHK, short for Northwest Hijacking, and it immediately kicked off a frenzy of federal activity. Hundreds of agents were deployed across the Pacific Northwest. There was dense forests, rugged terrain, and inclement weather made the search practically impossible. The Washington River and surrounding areas were combed for days. Parachute clubs, skydiving schools, military bases were all contacted. The hope was that someone might recognize the profile, someone with knowledge of parachuting, aircraft, and explosives. But Cooper was a ghost. No parachute was found, no footprints, no torn clothing, no body. It was like he leapt into the storm and dissolved.
That is so crazy to me, because it's so true. Like, you think, like, somebody's got to know him. Like, somebody has to know something. Oh,
somebody knew him, yeah.
Like, he has parents, he's got a family, like, it's so wild to me.
And the other thing that the pilot did say was that, and I may touch on it a little later, they had to fly manual. He couldn't put it on autopilot because of the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Flaps and everything like that. I know people would probably comment saying, oh, you forgot about the flaps. He wanted the flaps at a specific thing, too. Mm-hmm. So their course, that south-southwest or south-southeast, wasn't guaranteed, like, to be dead on.
Mm-hmm.
They could have veered.
Yeah.
Because he was flying manually.
That's crazy.
So they could be looking in the completely wrong area.
Wrong area, right. Wow.
The FBI gathered details, statements from all witnesses, including the flight crew and passengers. Cooper had been oddly polite, even gentlemanly. He'd spoken in a calm, educated tone. He chain-smoked Raleigh cigarettes and sipped some bourbon and soda. Like I said, he even paid for his tab.
So wild to me that there was a time in the world where you could smoke on a plane.
Is it even more wild that you can get into a plane? I don't know if you can do it now. But a couple years ago, you could get into a plane and there would still be the cigarette thing.
Yeah, like the little ashtray thing or whatever. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Shows you how old the planes are.
Seriously.
But those engines get rotated. Like, they're on hours.
Yeah.
So it's like the body of the plane may be super old, but those engines are probably...
It is just so crazy to think about, though. Mm-hmm. It's like now it's like the biggest no-no ever. They make like 50 announcements. Like, no smoking on this plane. No electronic cigarettes. The whole nine. Mm-hmm. It's like, really? Because 50 years ago, y'all were just chain smoking on these things.
Yeah. Well, it's because nobody wants a secondhand smoke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They circulated the serial numbers of the ransom money across the nation. The thinking was simple. At some point, someone would try to spend one of those bills.
I didn't even think about the money.
The banks, casinos, racetracks, even amusement parks were put on alert. But for nearly a decade, silence.
Right, because what can you do with that money? They had to... Like, it's not just, here's your money, and that's that. Like, they had to have tracked it, no?
They're apparently, banks have, like, money set aside. Now, back then, apparently, they had money set aside for this stuff.
Because
in the 70s, plane hijackings were common.
I keep forgetting this was literally, what was it, 71?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were super common.
Okay.
Now, most of them were, apparently, they were people from Cuba trying to get back there.
Oh, okay.
So they'd hijack it because America wouldn't fly there.
So
they'd hijack the plane to try and fly home.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Then a break comes in 1980, almost 9 years after the hijacking. An 8-year-old boy named Brian Ingram was digging in the sand along the Columbia River near Vancouver, Washington. He unearthed a rotting bundle of $20 bills.
Hmm.
$5,800 in total. The crazy part? The serial numbers matched. They were part of the ransom money.
Get out of here.
This discovery set off a new wave of theories. Was this where Cooper had landed? Had the money washed downstream? Had Cooper buried it as a decoy? Or had it simply fallen from his pack mid-descent? No other trace of the remaining $194,200 has ever been found. And here's something chilling for the paranormal leaning among us. The bundle of bills was discovered upriver from the presumed flight path. So the river flowed down.
Down, right.
This was found up.
Yeah, that's weird.
How did it get there? Now here's where things get even stranger. Cooper didn't leave behind much, but what he did leave behind was unusual. He held onto the ransom note, smart guy, so it couldn't be analyzed. But he did leave behind his clip-on tie, a few cigarette butts, and a hair on the headrest. The FBI preserved the tie and eventually found trace elements on it, titanium particles used in specialized manufacturing like aerospace or chemical production. Was Cooper an engineer? A defense contractor? Someone with access to classified tech?
I feel like he had to have been something like that. Like, he knows all this about the plane. He knows all this about, like, has to be something like that.
Yep. But the forensic trail still went cold.
Of course it did.
And to make it even crazier, did you hear that?
Yeah, I did.
I don't know if you guys heard that.
That was
but
weird.
There was just a, like... Like, somebody was just knocking on the mics.
On the mic. Yeah, that was...
Weird. What makes it even crazier with the money is it was still bound in rubber bands.
Damn.
And rubber bands don't last that long.
Right.
So, how
Especially
was it...
Especially in water.
Yep.
Shit.
How was it still...
Oh, is this a picture of the money?
Yes.
Oh, my God. It's, like, disheveled. It's, like, yeah. barely
I mean,
even...
it was sitting in, like, yeah. buried in sand underwater, right. but... Or we'll say buried in sand.
That's crazy.
But it was like the rubber bands were still bound around it. They were very fragile.
Yeah.
But they were still bound. They did studies on those rubber bands. They would have dissolved within a year. Or it was either 1 or 3 years.
What the hell?
How was the rubber band still around those?
Right.
In the aftermath, the FAA, or Federal Aviation Administration, implemented a simple but clever piece of tech across all Boeing 727s. It's called the Cooper Vane. It's a latch that prevents the rear stairway from being lowered during flight. Cooper had exploited the design flaw perfectly. After him, that back door was forever sealed in midair.
That's so crazy that they literally call it the Cooper Vane.
It was like a, it looks like a handle that sticks out from the side of the plane when it's on the ground. And then when it gets up and flying, the air force pushes it closed and that, like, latches it. So in order to open that door, you'd have to disengage that spring that's got the air pressure on it. As for Cooper's fate, well, that remains the million-dollar mystery. The FBI has long speculated he didn't survive the jump. He leapt into a thunderstorm wearing a trench coat and loafers, using, some say, using a non-steerable military parachute. Some say a steerable parachute, but it wasn't exactly ideal gear for precise landing. The landing zone, pitch black, heavily forested, riddled with rivers and ravines. Special Agent Larry Carr, who inherited the cold case in the 2000s, famously said, "No experienced parachutist would have jumped into the pitch black night in the rain with a 200-mile-an-hour wind in his face, wearing loafers and a trench coat." So was Cooper a desperate amateur with a death wish? Or was he a ghost-like professional who had planned his vanishing act for years? The mystery captivated America for decades, and then, quietly, in 2016, the FBI closed the case. Officially, anyway, Cooper was never identified, and no one was ever arrested. I think it's crazy that they kept that case open for so long.
Yeah. Well, how do you close it? Mm-hmm. You have no answers. Well, how do you close it?
I guess it's like you can't. There was a thing. I forget who it was. Somebody signed, or judge signed, or something like that signed. So if they ever found Cooper, they could prosecute him. Because, you know, like, the statute of limitations.
Yeah, right.
They did things
that
they ever...
Yeah, because we're way past the statute of limitations with this one.
Well, I mean, I don't know the laws. Now we have to phone in Ron.
Yeah,
if you know this, I'd be like, how do you
know
that?
For, like, I watch a lot of SVU, but I was going to say I know it for, like, sexual assault cases, not for, like, actual, like... I don't think there is a thing for, like, murder. I'm like, is there a statute of limitations for murder? There shouldn't be.
There shouldn't be. I know there's double jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
So when the FBI began its investigation, it was confident that Cooper wouldn't be able to stay hidden forever. They eventually considered over 800 suspects, whittling the list down to about 24 viable candidates. Some of them were career criminals. Others were military veterans. A few had no record at all, but they fit just enough of the physical description to kind of raise an eyebrow.
That's crazy. You don't have any experience with flying or anything, but you look enough like this guy, so we're going to take you.
We're going to check you out. So here we have some of the most compelling and most controversial names that have floated to the surface over the past 50 years. We're going to start with Richard Floyd McCoy Jr., the copycat, or the culprit. McCoy remains one of the most frequently cited suspects, and for good reasons. On April 7th, 1972, less than 5 months after the D.B. Cooper hijacking, McCoy hijacked a commercial flight from Newark to Los Angeles. He passed a note to the flight attendant demanding $500,000, 4 parachutes, and a refueling stop. Sound familiar?
It does.
He was a Vietnam veteran, a helicopter pilot, and an experienced skydiver. After getting the money, he jumped from the plane using the 727's rear stairway, just like Cooper. Now you figure, you're talking 5 months. Mm-hmm. That Cooper vane was not installed.
Yeah.
The FBI caught up with McCoy, convicted him, sentenced him to 45 years in prison. But he wasn't done.
Of course not.
In 1974, he escaped using a hijacked garbage truck. His freedom was short-lived. The FBI tracked him to Virginia later that year, and he was killed in a shootout.
Doesn't surprise me. He's like, I'm not going back there again. Please don't make me do this again.
Despite the similarities, the FBI eventually ruled out McCoy. Two flight attendants who had spent time with Cooper said McCoy didn't match the physical description. But McCoy's own children, Shante and Richard III, now publicly say that they believe their father was Cooper. In 2023, they presented the FBI with a parachute and harness found in a storage shed, along with a log book they claim places him near the 1971 hijacking site. Investigators haven't confirmed the authenticity, but some sleuths say the parachute rig is one in a billion. Could McCoy have pulled off the perfect crime twice?
Okay. Do you want to hear something absolutely crazy?
Hmm?
I'm looking at this picture, and I'll post it on the Instagram when we do this so you guys know what I'm talking about. This picture, he's the one in the handcuffs, correct?
Correct.
Okay, well, why does the guy in the sunglasses look more like D.B. Cooper than him?
Yep.
I thought I was like, okay, that's him.
Mm-hmm.
That literally looks like the mugshot,
looks
like
just
the sketch.
Like him.
That's so crazy. That is a crazy coincidence, though, because how did... I don't know. Twice?
Yeah, but I think he could have just personally gotten the idea from all this stuff. It was so, like, the Cooper story was so, like, in the media, in the public, like...
Right, you and you said it was, what, 5 months after?
Yeah. So you could have just figured it all out.
For
and
sure.
Him being like, I'm going to... He did it. Yeah. He got away with it,
right.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Breaking
out of prison in a hijacked trash truck is... But kind of funny, too.
Yeah,
I'm not going to lie.
I think he also kept the money in his closet.
Period.
It was either him or there's another suspect who did.
Love.
Next, we have Robert Rackshaw. He was a Vietnam vet, expert pilot, and a man with a colorful past. He was investigated in the 70s for fraud, check kiting, and even the murder of his stepfather, though he was eventually acquitted of that charge. In 1978, Rackshaw attempted to fake his own death in a rented airplane by logging a false mayday call. He ended up spending 2 years in prison for fraud and aircraft theft. Authors Tom Colbert and Tom Schizolzi spent 5 years investigating Rackshaw and published their findings in The Last Master Outlaw. They believe encrypted messages sent to the newspapers after the hijacking contained hidden codes pointing directly to Rackshaw. He had a military background, parachuting skills, and the kind of intelligence that may have linked him to covert operations. But here's where things get strange. Rackshaw once hinted at being Cooper during an interview, then laughed it off. His lawyer called the theory the stupidest thing I've ever heard. He died in 2019, never admitting to anything. Yet, the whispers never stopped.
See, I feel like he... Not to discredit this man or anything, but I feel like he was so calculated and, like, smart with, it, like, how mm-hmm. he did things. Sorry to this man. I feel like he didn't have it. I don't know. I feel like he didn't really have it in him.
So, unlike Rackshaw McCoy, Kenneth Christensen wasn't a criminal. He was a former flight attendant for Northwest Orient Airlines, the very airline Cooper hijacked. He'd also worked as a mechanic and a purser and had a military background as a paratrooper. After the hijacking, he started spending money more freely, even buying a house with cash, which raised eyebrows considering his modest salary. His brother claimed that on his deathbed in 1994, Kenneth said cryptically, "There is something you should know, but I cannot tell you." Christensen matched many physical descriptions. He was quiet, professional, and familiar with the Boeing 727's design. Some believe he knew about the plane's rear stair functionality from his job, and his military history gave him just enough parachuting knowledge to make the jump possible, though maybe not survivable. No hard evidence has ever surfaced. Still, his name continues to come up in Cooper circles. Now, we have Sheridan Peterson, who might be the most under-the-radar suspect, which is ironic because he was literally on the radar within a week of the hijacking. Peterson was a former Boeing employee and had worked on the 727 flight manual, giving him immediate knowledge of the aircraft's mechanics. He was also a skilled skydiver, once working as a smoke jumper in Montana, and even had ties to the very parachute center that later provided the chutes used in the Cooper case.
That's ironic.
But Peterson had blue eyes, not brown, and a detail that contradicts flight attendants' reports. He also wasn't a smoker, while Cooper chain-smoked Raleighs throughout the flight. At the time, Peterson claimed he was living in Nepal, but offered no proof he hadn't traveled back to the U.S. Despite the contradictions, some theorists think Peterson fits. A capable outdoorsman, knowledgeable about aircraft, and already linked to Boeing. If Cooper survived the jump, Peterson wouldn't have had the skills to vanish.
I don't know, I feel like the flight attendant, like, being so set about the eyes is, like, why would you not believe her?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like that's not a detail that you're gonna miss, like, forget, or, like, accidentally, yeah. Oh, like, maybe his eyes were brown. No, I feel like she definitely remembers,
mm-hmm.
like...
There's also, I can't think of his name now. There's also a guy who passed away, and he told his best friend he was Cooper, and they wrote a book. And apparently that guy even has the long johns like he was wearing the night of the jump and stuff like that. That's an interesting one. I just heard that, like, you know, I was listening to a podcast to, like, touch up on this. And I just heard it and I was like, wow, that was interesting. Hence why I don't remember the guy's name. I literally, it was probably like 5 o'clock this morning. It's now 5:30 at night and I heard it. But that info stuck in there.
Yeah.
Just not the people's names. Now, here's kind of where things take a twist. Florence Schaffner, one of the flight attendants on Flight 305, later reported in the months following the skyjacking that she believed she was being stalked. a man would board flights, she was working, and watch her from the back of the plane. He allegedly told her, "I know the hijacker from prison. He wants to talk to you. He was in the Bay of Pigs. He works for the CIA. It sounds wild, but it feeds into the larger theory that Cooper was part of a government operation and that his mission, whatever it was never supposed to be discovered. Maybe the hijacking was a cover for something else. Maybe he was never meant to survive the jump. Or maybe he was extracted. We'll never know for sure. But when the FBI's best minds can't close a case for 50 years, it's hard not to wonder, was there something that they weren't meant to find?"
It is kind of crazy, because what do you mean? 50 years, you couldn't find any bit more of information than you already started with?
And I know some people are probably like, the evidence. We're getting to it right now.
Just hold your horses. Mm-hmm.
Hold them up.
Here we go.
So in all these decades, there was only a few pieces of physical evidence that have ever been definitively connected to Cooper. You have the decayed bundle of $20 bills found by Brian Ingram in the 80s. The clip-on black tie left on Cooper's seat, which bore unusual titanium traces, led to speculation that Cooper had worked in the aerospace and chemical labs. A few cigarette butts that you figure you could test for DNA, but like any great law enforcement story, I guess you would want to say,
they threw it out. It's gone. It's missing.
They were discarded before they could extract DNA.
Fork found in kitchen. Like, it's crazy.
Now, some say discarded, some say lost. I would lean more towards lost. I really don't feel like the FBI would be like, we've never solved this case, let's just throw these away.
Either way, though, like, that's such a thing that, like, I feel like you don't misplace that. Like, that's not the type of thing that you're just like, oh, no. I'll just leave it here and go back for it later.
That, I guarantee, was one of those things where they were moving.
Yeah.
Like, we're going from this building to this building, and it was time to move the evidence, and they fell out. Like, it shifted or something happened, and they just disappeared. A single hair that was found on the headrest, but that yielded no usable DNA. Everything else, the parachute, the briefcase bomb, the clothing, the rest of the money, simply disappeared. But the search never stopped. If anything, the story only got weirder, and more people started looking outside the box. Not just for a suspect, but for a theory. And that's where the paranormal, the speculative, and the conspiratorial start creeping in. I'm going to, at the end, kind of go over what I think, but it's definitely just mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can, this is just like the Amelia Earhart.
Yeah,
you can get so deep into this with things that it's just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Now here's where things start to veer into the paranormal territory. We have a trucker sighting near Lewis River Road, one of the most sighted, closest to ghost moments came from a Reddit post where a truck driver describes passing a man in 1970s attire, a dark suit, a white shirt, standing alone on November 24th, 1971, near Lewis River Road. By the time the driver circled back, the man had vanished. Though reports vary and details are thin, for many, this fleeting figure is the chilling kernel of a real-world ghost of Cooper sighting. Paranormal theme podcasts and anecdotal lore podcasts like The Cooper Vortex, History's Greatest Mysteries, which is just absolutely fun to say, and Unexplained Mysteries occasionally reference anecdotal or secondhand reports of anomalies. I can't say that word. Thank you.
Thank you.
Time distortion, strange lights, isolated figures near Cooper's drop zone. These aren't eyewitness interviews, but they reflect how paranormal communities have folded the Cooper case into a broader discussion of vortex-like energy, dimensional rifts, and unexplained phenomena. Terraforming a legend into folklore. Celebrations like D.B. Cooper Day in Ariel, Washington, and CooperCon in Seattle draw a mix of true crime fans and paranormal curiosity seekers. At these gatherings, formal panels on suspects sit alongside speculative talks on energetic hotspots of Cascades. Though there are no recorded ghost stories, the festival atmosphere lends itself to folklore creation, where fans share personal tales of feeling watched or seeing someone out of place in the woods. Pop culture hasn't only dramatized the hijacking, but it's also re-imaged Cooper as more than human. Marvel's Loki series presents Cooper as an interdimensional prankster, transported by the Bifrost, effectively a portal. Graphic novels and speculative fiction further explore parallel realities, tying Cooper's disappearance to the science fiction elements, dimensional hopping, secret experiments, or otherworldly disappearances. On forums like R.D.B. Cooper and R. High Strangeness, you'll find threads with theories ranging from Cooper turned CIA ghost to Cooper joined Bigfoot. These aren't mainstream, but they reflect how Cooper has become a blank canvas for the weird. Now, why does Cooper lend himself to the paranormal? Well, there was no body, no definitive evidence. The lack of closure invites speculation. There's cultural rituals, festival, pods, fictional depictions, all keeping that legend alive. Geography matters. The Cascades are already steeped in UFO lore, Bigfoot myths, and EM anomalies. Cooper just slots right in. These factors make him a natural figure for shadow stories, even if there aren't formal hauntings. There's something about the Cooper case that sticks. Maybe it's that he didn't hurt anyone. Maybe it's the image of a man in a suit calmly stepping out of a plane into a storm, never to be seen again. He's become a part of American mythology, a folk anti-hero. In a way, Cooper represents freedom, escape, beating the system. That might explain why even 50 plus years later, people are still writing books, posting YouTube theories, and combing forests for clues.
Here we are talking about it on a podcast, mm-hmm. though.
And here's something else. If you've ever hiked in the Pacific Northwest and felt like someone or something was watching you, well, you're not alone. There are dozens of accounts online from people who swear they've seen strange lights, heard odd sounds, or even spotted someone who looked like Cooper. Coincidence? Probably. But it'll still make you wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether D.B. Cooper was a brilliant criminal, a military-trained ghost jumper, or just a guy who got very, very lucky, he left behind a mystery that may never be solved. And if you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have your own theory about D.B. Cooper, which I'm going to talk about mine in a second, or maybe even a story about seeing something strange in the woods, drop us a message at ominousarchives@gmail.com. We would love to hear it. Now, my theory?
What's your theory?
I have a couple.
I'd love to hear it.
He was an American.
Okay.
Because in some of the, like, the listening up that I, like, did, one big thing they kept pointing out, he asked for American currency.
Mm-hmm.
He kept asking for, like, he was specific on...
American.
Yeah, so, yeah. And what makes it a little more interesting is there was a release in Canada of a comic called Dan Cooper. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Maybe he was a Canadian.
Yeah. So I think that's a possibility. And I think to kind of loop onto that, he had an accomplice.
Yeah.
And I think the dude who bought the house with cash,
uh-huh.
I think he may have been
his accomplice.
His accomplice.
He worked for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the way they did it was dude got back to Canada,
uh-huh.
cashed it in Canada, because at that time they wouldn't.
Right,
they wouldn't look for the bills in another country.
Right.
And then gave the guy back the money.
Uh-huh.
Like, gave him back his portion of the money, so it couldn't be traced.
That's insane.
Right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's what I think. You have any theories?
I think the craziest part to me is, like, do I really think that he survived after jumping out of that plane? Like, honestly, like, that really is, like, that's the biggest question for me. Because, like, how? Like,
yeah, that's the big thing. Did he survive? Could he ever survive?
With some willy-nilly parachute from some parachute school if you don't know how to work it?
Yeah.
Like, no. Mm-hmm. I don't see it.
I do think what's wild is the just nothing's been found.
Right, like nothing, but these
no parachute was ever found. $20 bills. So the other thing is because of the storms and stuff, maybe he didn't take that into consideration, and he got blown ridiculously far off course.
True.
Like, what if we're talking, he landed in Washington? Like, what if he got blown? I would have to look up the path. You can look it up. There's, it's like, you know, it's all over the place. What if you look at that path? What if he got blown in, like, the next state over? Mm-hmm. You know, like, people are just not, you know, trying to think outside the box.
It's crazy.
Or he got blown, like, even further into Washington, and he just didn't think about it, and he may not have survived, but maybe just the whole search area is wrong, because you're not, like, trying to incorporate the winds and the, like, crazy things that can happen. That is our Dan Cooper episode. We have to credit that episode to Sam. She wrote it. She has been healing, I think, some of our episodes. We're so appreciative of the help. You can go check her own podcast out at Scare Me Sam. And you can also check her blog out, scaremesam.com. And next week, don't forget to check back, because we're going to dive back into more strange and haunted stories down here in the Ominous Archives. See ya.
See ya.